This is 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. The topic for this episode is Hurricane Matthew. Joining the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Jeff Frederick, are Drs. Dan Barbie and Robert Schneider from the Department of Political Science and Public Administration, Dennis Swanson, Dean of the Library, and Morgan Jones from the Office of Advancement. Get ready for 30 Brave Minutes.
Almost a year ago, Hurricane Matthew, the southernmost formed Category 5 in history, killed nearly 600 people from here to Haiti, dropping almost 20 inches of rain in parts nearby, damaging over 1 million American structures, leading to the temporary evacuation of 3 million and the loss of power and water for millions more. At the time, the storm was the 10th worst natural disaster in economic totality to impact the United States. For us in this area, we witnessed the cresting of the Lumber River. Kinston saw the same with the Neuse, Greenville with the Tar. The accumulation of the water into houses and over vehicles, the closing of roads, the toppling of trees, brought the storm directly into the lives of families who faced the difficulties of darkness and no water. North Carolina, the second largest rural state in the Union by population, faced a challenge of unimaginable complications. First responders saved lives. Family and community members checked on each other, pooled resources, and got through each day and night. City and county and state and federal government coordinated, communicated, and started the process of getting so many into and then out of a shelter, and then helping to find a way to move ahead. Relief, church, and community organizations came and kept coming. Folks took care of each other, building hope and overcoming the waters one day at a time. UNC Pembroke became a staging area for National Guard troops. Some of our buildings and stormwater systems were damaged. Many of our students, faculty, and staff saw their friends, family, and neighborhoods confront the literal challenge of starting over. The word volunteer took on a new meaning as this part of the state pulled together, built bridges where walls had existed, and took the needs of their neighbors as their very own. Various small business assistance groups got on the ground to help with picking up the pieces and figuring out a way to make payroll and move ahead. It was a year ago, but then a year later, so many of us are still transported back in time when we see some of the damage of Hurricane Harvey or Irma, or catch a whiff of stagnant water, or see a piece of wet carpet. For those that lost so much, for those that lived much of the last year in a trailer or a hotel, for those whose businesses are not yet back to full strength, we offer our support and our willingness to help connect you. For those on our campus and our community that have spent the last year investing in each other in every way, from checking on neighbors to dropping off bottled water or clearing down limbs, to holding jobs for storm-affected people even while they were rebuilding their lives and unable to work regular shifts, we say well done. And for our first responders in emergency management, our city, county, state, and federal government leaders, we say thank you. Our topic for today is the response, the relief, the recovery, and the resiliency of southeastern North Carolina in the context of Hurricane Matthew. Thanks to Bob Schneider, Dan Barbie, Dennis Swanson, and Morgan Jones for joining us today. Each experienced the hurricane as both a resident of the region and an expert in one form or fashion or another. Where were each of you when the storm hit and the waters began to rise? Bob, start us off.
Of course, I was at home in Lumberton, and as the storm came in, I was kind of relieved it was going to stay offshore. Maybe it wasn't going to be such a bad hit. But then, of course, it stalled, and we had record amounts of rain. In our neighborhood, we had up to 12 inches, and the water rose, and it kept rising by Monday. It had risen to the point where we were forced to evacuate by boat. And fortunately, we did not get water in our house, and our damage was relatively minimal under the circumstances. But, of course, one of the things that really hit my attention, you know, I've spent many years studying natural disasters, studying preparedness, response, mitigation, recovery. But for the first time in my life, I was in the middle of one. I wasn't just reading about an event or watching on television as other people were evacuating their homes. I was there. And for all that I knew and all that I had studied and all that I thought I understood, going through the experience was very enlightening, to say the least.
Absolutely. What about the rest of y'all?
Well, I'm Dan Barbie. I live in Southern Pines, and so we were even further inland and really elevated quite a bit compared to most of Robeson County. And so I didn't get impacted quite as adversely as Robert and some of the other folks. Moreover, I was able to check it out on the media, on TV mostly, and it turns out over a rather extended period of time, I had an opportunity to watch the hurricane build in intensity. The rain continued to drop and also in great amounts, and basically to examine what I have been studying for the better part of 30 years, disaster recovery. And I was also impressed with the tenacity, if you will, of the responder community, mostly in Robeson County and the surrounding area, Cumberland County, which got impacted extremely adversely. And I had a number of graduate students who actually put together photographic records of the neighborhoods in which they were trapped or in which they lived. And so I'm finding that, you know, ordinarily Cumberland County, Robeson County, the UNCP's footprint, actually, the six counties or thereabouts, has we had a situation where we were in the middle of it, unlike most other hurricanes. We're normally a host county for evacuation and shelters, but not in this case. We were right in the middle of it, and UNC Pembroke was right in the middle of that middle.
Yeah, in fact, lots of people left the coast to come here, and they got a dose of something they weren't expecting.
Absolutely. So I was fortunate in terms of very minimal damage, no evacuation that I know of in my area, and we did a lot of sheltering, a lot of responding, a lot of supplies, and it was a community-wide effort.
Morgan, where were you?
Well, I was at home with my 12-month-old, but here in Pembroke, North Carolina, but nearby city, Lumberton, North Carolina. My family was getting ready to celebrate 30 years in business, Fuller's Barbecue in Lumberton. And so the night before Hurricane Matthew, my mom closed up. She had on her rain boots, and they were preparing for the storm, what they thought was going to be minimum. The day of when Hurricane Matthew hit, we were actually going to close, but we had committed to catering a wedding that day, and my uncle didn't want to let the bride and the groom down, so we opened till 12 o'clock. The water started coming into Fuller's. We went, my mom and my uncle and my cousin went and bought sandbags, and they were trying to stop the water from coming in. They were moving all the tables downstairs to upstairs. By the time they finished that, the water was at the cash register. So they realized, okay, all these catering trucks and vehicles, we need to move. We need to get to Satterthwaite, which is a close by community. So they were able to do that and save our vehicles by the time they got back, though. Most of our tools in the kitchen were already floating, so it was already too late. That week, we were getting ready to celebrate 30 years, and we've been closed ever since, and we haven't reopened in Lumberton.
And I drive out of the neighborhood where Fuller's is every day, and I see that bright green rooftop as the landmark, and when it's covered with water, it's a surreal experience.
Yeah. We were able to, the way we were able to find out that Fuller's was completely flooded was the Weather Channel. My aunt, who lives in Delaware, called and said Fuller's is completely underwater.
It's no good when the Weather Channel is in your neighborhood, is it?
Or
it's,
floating around in a canoe. No
Dennis, you're a native Californian. You got to experience something from a totally different perspective.
Well, I did. I'd probably only been in the state for 3 or 4 months by that time. I live here in Pembroke. Where I was somewhere between my house and the university. I made about 4 trips back and forth. And I was on my cell phone with the Wilmington office of the National Weather Service. I'm a weather spotter. I have been for 12 years. And I brought my station and all my equipment from California and set it up here. And so they were calling me. I was calling them. They wanted on-site reports, and I was also the dean of the library, I was concerned about our main reading room, which has a large fiberglass, you know, paneled roof that I was a little concerned about whether it would survive. And we still had on campus, we probably had 300 or 400 students still on campus on Saturday. I remember one student meeting her. She's trying to get to her dorm, and faculty row was about 2.5 feet of water at 3 o'clock, and I put her on my shoulders and carried her across the street to get her to the dorm and wandered back. It's a little different. I was a L.A. policeman for 15 years, so disasters are kind of, you know, second nature to me. This was a unique disaster. It wasn't a fire or a flood or earthquake, but it was a lot of flooding. It was a lot of interesting things going on.
Well, let's circle back a little bit and look at this from more of a discipline perspective. How do meteorologists, emergency planners, government agencies, what do businesses all start to do to prepare for a storm? Take us inside preparation.
Well, meteorologists, what people understand is the National Weather Service only has a limited number of weather stations. They really rely on people like me to run our own little private weather station. And so my station uploads data every 3 minutes to the National Weather Service, to MADIS, to 3 or 4 other entities. For instance, here in this region, ideally, the National Weather Service would like to have a station every 5 square miles. That gives them the best coverage, and they can make accurate forecasts. Until I put my station in operation, there was no reporting weather station in this area between the airports in Laurinburg and Lumberton. And there's still only one new one. The university's just recently put a weather station in service. And so there's hardly any reliable information in this immediate region. And that's part of it's an expensive hobby. It costs about $2,000 for the equipment that you want. And so they're trying to gather data. If you remember Irma just a few weeks ago, initial reports were Irma was going to come down even as it was approaching the Tampa-St. Pete area. The Space Coast on the other side of the coast wasn't really that concerned, but Irma wobbled about 20 miles to the east, and the Space Coast was devastated with an enormous amount of flooding. I think Jacksonville's still under coastal flood watch right now.
Well, from the emergency management perspective, disaster preparedness is an everyday event. I mean, every community across the country begins with the assessment of their risks and their vulnerabilities. We know from their history that they are prone to have certain types of natural disasters, whether it's wildfires or hurricanes or tornadoes. And so they do a thorough risk assessment, and that includes assessing impacts on infrastructure of hypothetical storms, impacts on at-risk populations, that type of thing. And so it's an ongoing activity. And then, of course, they do the training, acquire the technology, and develop the planning so that they can respond when a disaster actually happens. But, you know, planning and response are just two parts of the puzzle. To be thoroughly prepared for a disaster, you got to get involved with this thing we call hazard mitigation. Once you've identified risks and vulnerabilities, communities can take certain steps to reduce the impact of an expected event. But, you know, even the nature of expected events changes, so you constantly have to reassess risk and vulnerability. For example, in 2015, for the first time, FEMA required communities begin thinking about climate change when they do risk assessment. Now, every community has to produce what is called a hazard mitigation plan. That's a federal requirement, and is often tied to having access to federal funding. Included in that mitigation requirement in 2015 was a FEMA requirement that we not just look at the past and the history and try to project on that basis what the future will bring. We now take a look at the science surrounding climate change to anticipate an increase in risk and vulnerabilities. You know, warmer air holds more water, thus there will be more rain. Rising sea level means stronger storm surges, et cetera. So it's an ongoing process, but it's more than just one component, as Dr. Barbie can tell you, recovery is a very important part of preparing. When you recover from one disaster, the idea is to make the community stronger, make it more hazard resilient as you recover. And I'll let Dr. Barbie say a few words about this.
I want to go back just a little bit before we get into recovery and think a little bit more about the university's footprint and the area of impact. The area here, particularly Robeson County, first of all, our county is the largest in the state, about 944 square miles. Second of all, this county has an unusual topographic outlook. Basically, Robeson County is somewhere on an average between 125, 150 feet above mean sea level, which means that, and it's flat, and the water is not going anywhere. And in fact, even in normal times, you can get a couple of inches of rain on this campus, and the drains are flat enough that the water ponds. Okay, so you have a variety of issues like that, in addition to the fact that, and this is speaking more to planning and to preparedness and response, the county is rural. It's a large county, and it has no major large cities with the exception of Lumberton, which is only about 22,000. After that, it really drops off. The point being this, that the ability of the responder community, first of all, there's not that many of them. Second of all, many of the ones that did respond so dynamically were volunteers. So Robeson County and the surrounding counties do have a very strong, what amounts to an interagency compact, interjurisdictional memorandum of agreement with the other counties. And so when the rains built up, started building up, you started having serious issues. The point being that I'm making is that these floods, the floodwaters, were not just moving across a county or multiple counties, but they were dropping, there they were. So it was a very difficult time. Talked to a few responders afterward. It was a very difficult time. Mobility, asset location, pre-staging, pods, points of distribution after the fact, all these were very difficult. And I'll just jump ahead a little bit and say that one of the more heroic tasks was done by the workers right here on this campus, in terms of hosting the responder community, including the National Guard, and including the 300 to 400 students who remained on campus.
We'll return to our panel in just a moment. UNC Pembroke and the College of Arts and Sciences are changing lives through education. To learn more about our 16 departments, college highlights, and news, as well as to find past episodes of 30 Brave Minutes and our digital journal Bravery, explore our website. You can also support our academic programs by clicking on the donate button. Additional news and events may be found by following us on Facebook at UNCP College of Arts and Sciences. Remember, wherever you hope to go, whatever you plan to do, you can get there from here.
So everybody's got a plan. The plan changes as new data comes in. But then when the actual event comes, you know, all of these complications prevent you from pulling out the plan and saying, all right, we're at page two. Let's everybody go. Things get in flux. Morgan, take the perspective of from not only from local businesses, but from local families. What were people doing that they told you that you know about as the storm got in, other than batteries and milk and bread?
Yeah, I don't think we were prepared at all for the impact of Hurricane Matthew. And that's just my personal opinion, thinking about Fuller's and being prepared. I mean, we were scrambling. I don't think we realized as much rain as we were going to get, the impact of the river located right next to the swamp and the flooding. We had no idea. I'm telling you, the night before, my mom would probably get me for saying this. She deposited, instead of going to the bank and depositing money, she deposited a bag full of T-shirts at the bank. I was freaking out. My uncle had to get in a canoe, go in the restaurant, and our money bag was floating around. I mean, literally, like, scrambling, trying to make sure everything was safe. So we weren't prepared at all.
How do you all start to process the aftermath of the storm? What from what the emergency planners did, from what the weather folks were doing, from what the recovery people, what worked? I mean, I think you've talked a little bit about this. What didn't work? How would we do things differently?
Well, of course, in the aftermath of any disaster occurrence, there's a lot of assessment that goes on by the professionals and within the communities. The two things that stand out to me in our experience here was the unprecedented nature of the event, okay? We had never had this kind of event this far inland, and it was almost impossible for us to have been as prepared as we would like to be. But hopefully what has been happening in the analysis and the aftermath as we rebuild, and of course we're using a lot of federal money and FEMA assistance and so forth to help communities rebuild. Hopefully they had flood insurance, but I cannot emphasize the importance of having that, by the way. If you are living in a flood-prone area, flood insurance is something you absolutely should get. But in addition to the actual rebuilding and bringing people, quote, back to normal, we have to appreciate that this storm may indicate that we're dealing with a new normal and that what was an unprecedented event may soon become something that happens maybe not frequently but often enough that we may have to make some different decisions in land use, different decisions in building codes and the like to strengthen our communities. We may have to do some things that we hadn't thought of previously. That's part of what you do in the aftermath of an event is you try to ask the question, what could we have done better so our community would withstand this impact? What could we have done better so that people would have been better served when the spam hit the fan, if you will? And I suspect that activity will be ongoing. We're now a year later. They're still engaging in that assessment and trying to improve, make our community more hazard resilient.
Yeah, I think that that's a good point. The Disaster Mitigation Act of 2000 mandates, as Robeson County well knows, and the other counties surrounding the university in our service area, the DMA 2000 mandates pre-disaster mitigation plans that are set up so that if there is a presidentially declared disaster, there is a series of projects available for almost immediate consideration, at least in terms of improving the resilience as well as the sustainability of the community. The other thing is now that about 6 or 8 years ago, FEMA launched a similar recovery directive nationwide. And so now you find areas like this that have traditionally not been in the direct pathway of major storms having to deal with recovery. Well, what do you do if you're in Robeson County? You have a variety of considerations that you have to undertake to deal with. The first one of which is being able to respond effectively. I've talked to a few responders. That was a major challenge, mainly because of the way this area is basically it's flat. There's nowhere for the water to go. It's unusual to get that much water, but there's nowhere for it to go. Second of all, the infrastructure needs to be improved. Some of the lifelines, water, sewer, power, social media, the towers, etc. All of these are going to have to be looked at, and they are being, in terms of being more resilient. Because it's a fairly low population area, and as a result, governmentally, you don't have anywhere near the amount of responder capability that you might have in other locations, in larger cities. The one exception to that, of course, in our service area would be Cumberland County, which is the fourth largest urban area in North Carolina, which is the 10th most populous state, and the damages were pretty severe over there. So you have the full menu of damages, types of damage, recovery options. You have the full menu of infrastructural capacity, governmental capacity pre-disaster. So now, one of the things that, I understand is occurring is that the emergency management infrastructure is being improved through training, exercising, and possibly new hires, as well as getting out into the community and creating some of the actual kind of organizations like CERTS, community emergency response teams, that FEMA initiated a number of years ago.
I want to say a quick word about infrastructure because you mentioned that, and it's very important, not only for Robeson County. Nationwide, our infrastructure is aging, and it's in a state of disrepair. Somebody once said about 80% of everything is broken or in a state of ill repair. But in particularly as it relates to natural disasters in all parts of the country, the infrastructure, which is aging, which is old, in a state of disrepair, even at its best, was not built to withstand the environmental impacts we have today, the storms we have today. So improving infrastructure is a vital priority in every community, and particularly in one that's just been hit, it's probably a good opportunity to get some federal funding to help do that.
Yeah, when that infrastructure is taxed and something is no longer operational, it changes all your planning, right? The roads that you had imagined sending responders to or relief supplies to suddenly are impassable. Dennis, you were going to jump in?
Well, and I would agree with Dr. Barbie comment on this too, but it being a policeman before and things, we're usually really good about interagency cooperation about day two or three into a disaster. Mm-hmm. Day one, not so much. I mean, even the loss of equipment, I think, on Saturday, for instance, school district buses that were underwater that could have been used to help move things and people around, they were lost within the first couple hours of the storm. There's always those sorts of things. So hopefully it'll be an impetus to kind of – and the storm was finicky. On Wednesday, even here in the planning on campus, on as late as Wednesday, we were saying, well, it's probably not going to do much here other than be a little bit of rain. Mm-hmm. And then it wobbled and slowed down. And on Friday, you're kind of chasing after it.
Hmm. Well, what happens next? What are the decisions a year in that need to be made now? And how do communities, and Morgan, maybe you can jump in on this, how do communities decide when to rebuild a home or a business and when to make a really painful decision not to?
Yeah, well, we're still in the process. We finally got word that we can't go to the original location in Lumberton. So now we're in the process of looking for high ground land that is reasonable, that my family can afford. And, I mean, our intentions wholeheartedly, we want to be back in Robeson County. The hurricane hit in October. By December, an opportunity came up in Rayford, North Carolina. We were able to open a second location there, and we had 75 employees who were traveling, who are still traveling from Lumberton, Robeson County to Rayford every day for work. And we opened 2 days before Christmas, and they were all grateful and excited, but there's no place like home. We definitely want to be back in Lumberton. It's just finding the right location, the right fit for our business.
The floodplain is preventing you from
We had to gut Fuller's. I mean, we pulled all the wiring out, the sheetrock, everything. It is a pretty sad situation. So we can't go back there.
Dennis, how does the weather community look a year later and say, what did we do well with our forecasting, with our predicting, with our warning the public, and what challenges need to be readdressed?
Well, I think part of it, and Noah Wilmington, I think, did as remarkable a job as they could. They could, frankly, use a few more people who do what I do. From Wilmington to Laurinburg, I'm looking at my map now, there are four reporting stations, and three of those are airports that have to have weather stations. Mm-hmm. So it is something to. And if you go up to Raleigh, there's a weather station on every block. And so they're able to really predict and see what's going on well there. Predicting and forecasting in a rural region without a lot of equipment is difficult. The university has put up a station here it wouldn't be a bad enterprise to have some remote stations even around on some of the farms and get cooperation that way. It's, again, like everything, it takes a little bit of money to do that. But it's a good process, because you're only as good in your preparation as the information you have to work with.
You know, and Dan and Bob, how will having lived through this to various extents change the way you teach and you write and you lecture about, you know, these sorts of topics that you all have been experts in for so long?
Well, one of the things that I like to think about is the capacity of a community, including a university or community colleges around our region, and a couple of other colleges and universities, to go ahead and consider building their own capability to respond and recover. And there are a variety of organizational modes, if you will, that they can use. As I said before, the community emergency response teams, the CERTs, were spawned by the San Francisco earthquakes of about 30 years ago. And so you do have a variety of options available around the region. You have our wonderful military over at Fort Bragg. They have enormous capacity. You have a large urban area in Fayetteville. So I think one of the things that needs to be occurring now, and it is to some extent, is the building of a network so that when you get beyond a single ICS response in a single community like Pembroke or like Lumberton or like Robeson County, you build it outward and you get into a unified command system. And Dennis knows exactly what I'm talking about there. And the same idea would be true of recovery. The fact is now that FEMA has, last time I checked, FEMA has their recovery teams that are out right now following the major three hurricanes that we've had recently. And these recovery teams are a new thing. They're out there, and I think Matt Campbell, the head of them, I talked to him, they are, in fact, this is a really ripe area for the building of better recovery capability in the direction of what I would call a sustainable recovery, of which mitigation is a big chunk.
Yes, I agree with all of that. In terms of changing the way I look at things or teaching, no, not at all, because I've studied and I know exactly what's happened, why it's happened, and what's probably going to happen next. One of the things that frustrates us in trying to move forward with the sort of things that Dan was just talking about or try to improve for the future is, if you take a look at it, within 6 months, maybe a year at the outside after disaster has occurred, your window is closed. That window of opportunity stays open for a very short time. It's often said, in order to understand the importance of emergency management, preparedness, response, recovery, mitigation, you have to have had a major event. But if that major event was 6 months in the past, or 9 months, or a year in the past, all of a sudden you forget, and the sense of urgency you have about doing something to improve the situation declines. So the time to make your progress, to do some of the things that Dan was just talking about, is in that 6 month to 10 month window after disaster has occurred. And that applies even to major events like earthquakes in California. You have to jump on it the minute it happens and try to get that progress moving toward, you know, in the first 6 to 8 months after the disaster occurs. I think we're seeing some positive movement in that direction here and locally, and as you say, FEMA is more active than ever. At the same time, I kind of fear that, 6 months from now, our conversation about this will not be quite as urgent.
Yeah. Well, let's end with kind of a quick lightning round. 1 year later, when you think about Hurricane Matthew, what comes to mind is
the look on people's faces when you went around the community, once you were able to, and you went to pick up some food or water, and just the look of shock and dismay And we tried our best, my wife and I, to advise people on how to contact FEMA to get some immediate relief, that sort. And it was amazing how very few people knew to do that. And so my recollection is people with that absolute look of shock and not knowing what they should have known, which means we should have done a better job of communicating both before and during the event so that people knew how to contact FEMA to get some immediate assistance.
How about the rest of y'all? 1 year later, when you think of Matthew, you think of what?
Just a heartbroken community and just complete exhaustion. Like I said, my family, we were getting ready to celebrate 30 years in business, a legacy my grandparents started, and everything just within a matter of a few days vanished. So, yeah, heartbroken.
And like I said, I was new to the community. I only been here for a few months, but it reminded me so much of the Northridge earthquake, which I lived through and responded through. Houses 2 miles from me, that not only was the house gone, the lot the house sat on was gone. And the same sorts of things here where the floodwaters not only wiped out the house, the channel of the river, I'm sure, has changed significantly in places, and the land where the house was probably doesn't exist anymore in a usable state. So that was the takeaway. The interpersonal relationships, I didn't have that many at that time, but the shock of from talking to longtime residents, I would stop and talk to people as anything, and they just utter disbelief that anything like this could ever possibly have happened in the community.
Well, in my field, political science, public administration, and having worked in this field for a number of years, one of the things that I discovered after this, first of all, is I got a lot of calls from students right in the middle of this. I got a call from one student who was out in the middle of a pond. I said, that's dangerous. There could be snakes or anything else. It's only October. And she said, I better move on out and get out of here because I'm almost up to my waist in the water. This is what I think. I think that if we're going to have sustainable recovery, and now's the time to do it, we need to consider the fact that, as Dennis said, we're going to have to consider this from the ground up. That is to say, we're going to have to take governmental institutions, community institutions, faith community folks, and put them all together into a single unit because of the fact that when we do have disasters in this region, that you can almost count on it in the future, they are going to be catastrophic. And so sustainable recovery is going to demand that we build our own capacity to respond and to mitigate and to recover in the future.
And I think as we close, what I'll remember a year later about Hurricane Matthew is, in the spite of the tragedy, all the ways in which ordinary people came together to look out for each other, to lift each other into boats, to get out of water-filled neighborhoods, to check on each other, to gather around a generator, to share some coffee or to charge up their car phone so that they could reach out to other people around and reconnect. Well, I want to thank the panel today for their time and their expertise. Really interesting recollection a year later from Hurricane Matthew. If you enjoyed 30 Brave Minutes today, I hope you'll pass it along to a friend. See you next time.
Today's podcast was produced by Richard Gay and transcribed by Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, UNCP, and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of UNCP. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of UNCP or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves!